This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a series of forums on local, national, and international issues important to people living in Utah. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, it's the rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in March of 2014, featuring Wes Moore, a U.S. Army veteran who served a tour of duty as a paratrooper and captain in Afghanistan. He later served as a White House fellow and special assistant to then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. In February of 2014, Moore visited the University of Utah to talk about his New York Times best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore. Moore's book juxtaposes his story of growing up in Baltimore and receiving a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Oxford University with another young man's story, a man also named Wes Moore and living in Baltimore, who was sentenced to life in prison for armed robbery and killing a policeman. Wes Moore's book tells how he learned about the other man with his same name, wrote a letter to the other Wes in prison, and how after they established a relationship, he soon learned the other Wes was not unlike himself. Moore's book, The Other Wes Moore, released in 2010, is based on these interactions. Again, Wes Moore spoke at the University of Utah back on February 27th, 2014. Here's Wes Moore.
This is not a memoir. This is not a biography. It's not an autobiography. I remember I took a class in college called Visions of the Self. It was actually a cool class because what you did was 1 week you would read an autobiography, and the next week you would read a biography of that person. And then the third week you would get together and you would discuss the differences. Basically, what did a person think of themselves versus what do other people think of them, right? It was a really cool class. But I think one of the main takeaways that I took from the class, well, there's two of them. One was that there's always differences between what a person thinks of themselves and what other people think of them, right? And the second major takeaway that I took from that class was, and this is with all due respect to Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus, is that if you're under the age of 25, you really shouldn't be writing autobiographies, right? And it's not the whole you haven't lived long enough argument, because that's a nonsense argument. But it is about how exactly can you understand your life in a sense of context? How exactly can we all understand our lives in a sense of perspective? And with this larger idea that the world isn't all about us, but the solution to the world's problem is. It's all about us. It's all about our ability to step up and do something. And you see it, I think, particularly, you know, and you talk about this whole idea of, you know, Generation Y and Generation X and millennial generations and all this kind of stuff. And regardless of where you find yourself falling into, it's kind of been a very interesting dynamic because I think one of the real challenges we're going to have long term, and there's kind of this gift and a curse of what's happened over the past decade. Where over the past decade and over the past two decades, you have people who are realizing that, you know what, we don't have to wait for politics to change our world. You know, if there's something going wrong in your community, the first natural instinct for people to say, well, that's the city council's fault, or that's the mayor's fault, or that's the governor's fault, or that's the Senate's fault, or that's the president's fault. And it's always someone's fault. But one of the really inspiring things that's happened over the past couple, you know, over the past decade or so is that people, you're watching this widespread and this groundswell movement of people who understand, I don't care whose fault it is. We've got a responsibility to do something about it. And it becomes our jobs to step up. And so you're watching how people realize that there are a multitude of ways to be able to make a difference in the lives of other people. One of the challenging things, though, and one of the things we have to fight against, is then taking it to have the pendulum swing too far. And why I'm so inspired by the work y'all are doing here, because sometimes the pendulum will swing too far, and then people will say, well, politics is not the place to get anything done. And that's not quite true. We need fighters who are willing to represent people in a variety of different platforms and standpoints. Whether it's in the nonprofit space, whether it's in the corporate responsibility space in the business, whether there's people who are willing to run for office, whether there's people who are appointed to positions, whether there's people who just simply take the responsibility of citizens seriously. We need all of it. We need everybody who's willing to step up and be part of something bigger than ourselves. As Dr. King said before, you know, we all can be great because we all can serve. That's the requirement. If you want to be great, serve. And so as we're going through the process, even thinking about, and again, I promise I would not make this a lecture. But I'd hope that as we're thinking of this process and thinking about even the stories, that people understand that not only is it not just about just these two kids, but there are very real policy implications that can't be ignored when we think about these two stories. This story is about the importance of intervention. It's about the importance of mentorship. It's the importance of expectations. It's the importance of a whole variety of different things. But you cannot understand these two stories without understanding how politics weaves into all of that as well. Without understanding that the policies that people were making and the decisions that policymakers were making can have both short and long-term consequences over the societies that we live in. You cannot understand these two stories without understanding the importance of education. And forget about the boys for a second. Forget about the fact that these are two kids, one who graduated from, you know, college and, well, high school, then college and graduate school and all that kind of stuff, and the other one who did not make it past 10th grade. Forget that for a second. And take it back a generation. Take it to the parents. Where Wes's mother was the first one in her family to go to college. She graduated from Baltimore City Community College with honors and then got accepted at Johns Hopkins University. She does 2 semesters at Johns Hopkins University, and then she receives a letter indicating that her Pell Grants were cut. And she knew that she could no longer afford to go to school. I can't help but think how different her life could have been had she had the chance to finish college. Because it's about much more than just the piece of paper. It's about much more than just the degree, the thing you get to frame and throw on a wall, how you get to change the first line in your resume, or how your LinkedIn profile looks a little more interesting. It's about the fact that as you move up in higher education, your networks are going to change. Your friendships are going to change, and your connections are going to change. I know if I took a quick straw poll of all the adults in the room right now and asked them, say, you know, for the people working now, you know, how many of you did not get your job through the classified ads or through Monster.com? Because that's not the way this game works. And I'd be the very first one to raise my hand. 70% of jobs in this country do not happen that way. 70% of jobs in this country happen because one day you will get a phone call or an email from somebody who says, I'm looking for someone that can do X, Y, or Z, and we have a mutual friend, and they suggested that I talk to you. Do you have time to talk? 70% of jobs in this country happen because one day you will call up a friend or a mentor or a teacher or a professor or the parent of a friend, and you will say, I'm really interested in getting into this field. Do you know anybody that does that? And they'll say, I know 3 people. Let me put you in touch. You can't understand these stories without understanding the virtue of education, and you can't understand the virtue of education without understanding the policies that went into making education accessible and available for everybody. You can't understand these stories without understanding housing policies. You can't understand these stories without understanding programs like SNAP. You can't understand these stories without understanding that while people might say, well, it's such a stretch to say that X, Y, and Z happened because certain programs were moved or certain programs were altered or certain programs were changed, the reason that I wanted to tell these stories the way I wanted to tell it is because I feel like it's the easiest open book test in the world. You can look at the back of a book and say the answer, oh, yeah, that's one about the two kids and the one name. But really what I wanted to do was take the reader on a journey. Have them start with 2 kids. Have them start with 1 kid who at 3.5 years old watched his father die in front of him, and the other kid who at 4.5 years old met his father for the first time. Start there. And then let the reader go on this journey. Policies matter. Impact matters. Empathy matters. And this is not about coming up with programs that's going to make sure that everyone has an ice cream cone and, you know, a candy bar every morning they wake up. But this is about coming up with platforms that we have access and opportunity for people to fulfill their dreams and be a contributing member to something bigger than just themselves. If we can do that, then we fulfilled our promise. If we can do that, then we fulfilled our desires. Having a bigger, honest conversation in this country about the future of this country means that we need to have everybody involved in it. We can never have that honest conversation if only a slither of the population is part of the conversation. And we can never have an honest conversation if only a slither of the population is even being thought about in that conversation. Pushing, fighting, and standing up for those who need and deserve a champion. Because in essence, what you have with these two stories are essentially these two kids who are both similar times in our life who are both searching for something more. They're both searching to be part of something bigger, both searching for help, both searching for positive examples, and one kid got it, and the other kid didn't. And now the world can bear witness to the final results of either our larger attention or our larger apathy. These things matter. And that's why this directly comes back to you. There's a whole lot of places, there's a whole lot of institutes, there's a whole lot of courses that you could be taking. You chose to focus on things where your sole responsibility is to serve. Because at the core of it, that's all that's really going to matter in any of our lives. What did we do to serve? What did we do to make humanity better? Who did we step up for? Who, to whom did it matter that we were even here in the first place? You've not just made it your passion point, you've made it your DNA. You've made it who you are. And for that, I know we're all just incredibly thankful and incredibly grateful. We're going to need people who are willing to step up in a wide variety of mechanisms. We're going to need people who are willing to be engaged on a variety of different platforms. And I'm excited that each of you have gone through the journey of finding exactly what that means for you and to make it matter that you were here in the first place.
That's Wes Moore. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today on the program, it's the rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in March of 2014. Wes Moore is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, it's a rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in March of 2014, featuring a talk given by Wes Moore, who is a youth advocate, an Army combat veteran, and author of the book The Other Wes Moore. He spoke about the book and answers questions from the audience of students.
Hi, I'm Aline. Hi, a non-traditional Aline. Student here at the U, obviously. Right. I loved your book. It was amazing. But I thought one of the most poignant moments of the book was when you realized you were not going to be an NBA star. Yeah. And in working with young people, I'm wondering how often you run into having to make them realize that same thing and how you deal with that.
Great question, Aline. Great question. I still don't think I've fully gotten over the fact that I'm not going to be an NBA star. There's still time. You know, it's funny. There's an author, a guy named John Edgar Wideman, who, brilliant professor. I believe he's now at Bowdoin. I'm not sure. I believe he's in Boston. But anyways, basketball star coming out of high school, basketball star in college. And he wrote this really great book basically about how the first time that he went to the basketball court as he got older and he went to the basketball court and he just saw, you know, the kids were just running circles around him and his knees hurt and his back hurt. And he said, that was the moment right then when I knew it's over. And he said it was kind of like dealing with the death of a family member for him because he'd grown up with it. He'd grown up playing basketball. That's what he did and that's what he was good at. And to finally realize that it's gone, you got to give it up. He said it was like, again, watching someone who you're close to pass away. And I think for me it wasn't as dramatic because, you know, I realized pretty quick, I was like, I better come up with a plan B because these guys are pretty good. But I think you actually often get that from people where this idea where they're like, oh, I'll just, you know, I know I'm going to go on to the NBA. I know I'm 5'5", but I mean, this is where I'm going. Or I know I'm going to be a star, you know, wide receiver in the NFL, and I know I run a 6-second 40, but I mean, that's what I'm going to do. And it's kind of like, yeah, you should probably start thinking about some other options as well. And this is not about killing your dream. Everybody should have a dream. And if that's your dream, that's perfectly fine. But it is about how can we come up with constructive alternatives for it. And so, you know, one thing we all have to actually often do with our kids is, you know, and there's a hip-hop artist guy named Jim Jones. And he was actually doing some work with some of our kids. And he said something that I thought was actually pretty interesting, where he said, you know, how many of you guys want to be a rapper? And, you know, three quarters of the hands go up and everybody thinks they're going to be, you know, the new Jay-Z and all that kind of stuff. And he says, you know, the truth is that, so all you guys are passionate about hip hop, but he's like, but the truth is, he's like, you know, you guys look at me and you think, you know, oh, he's making money and he's doing all this kind of stuff. And he says, you know who makes more money than me? My accountant. You know who makes more money than me? My lawyer. You know who makes more money than me? My real estate agent. You know who makes more money? And he's basically, he said, because his point is, because I'm only one of their clients. And his point and how he wanted our students to think about it, and I'm really glad he kind of brought it and brought it to that framework, was you can be passionate about something and find ways of being involved in the world of whatever that something is without necessarily thinking that you need to be the person, you know, shooting three-pointers from 35 feet away or being able to throw a ball flat-footed for 60 yards. That there's a lot of ways to be engaged and there's a lot of ways to be involved. And so this isn't about killing a dream, but it is about making sure that that dream is broad enough and expansive enough that you're going to win no matter what, and making sure that's real. And part of the challenge, and I think part of the thing that we have to do a better job of societally, as a society, is making sure that level of access is there, that people even know that's even available. How do we make sure that kids understand what's even possible? Because in many cases, kids will do what they know is there, and they'll do what they know is available. So if we're only showing them a limited world, how can we expect them to have an expansive vision? It doesn't make sense. I mean, the work that's going in, the whole idea of a lot of the work that's actually taking place right now is on how do we think about an expansive vision for our children so they know that there's a whole lot more than just what's directly in front of them. That's the genius. That's the creativity. That's how we trigger into something much bigger in the hearts and the minds of all of our kids, because we're finally allowing them to dream for themselves. You know, there was one line in the book where I was talking about where, you know, when people say, well, the thing about you is that you got sent away in the other West End. I said, listen, Wes moved multiple times, and Wes lived, in many cases, lived in better neighborhoods than I lived in. But here's the reality. What happened to me wasn't the fact that I was physically transported. And moved me from Baltimore to the Bronx or to military school or whatever, that didn't change my way of thinking. What changed was that I found myself surrounded by people who helped me to understand that the world is much bigger than what was just directly in front of me. People who helped me to understand that there was never going to be a single accident of birth, not being black, not being poor, not being from Baltimore or the Bronx or fatherless, that was ever going to define me or that was ever going to limit me. And so in essence, what they did was they taught me what it meant to be free. Our job is to teach freedom to as many kids as humanly possible. Because if we can teach them that, they'll figure the rest of that other stuff out. They'll understand how big and wide and expansive the world is, and we can help them find their own way. But they first have to understand the world of freedom in which they're living in. And I'll say one more quick point about that. You got me going. Part of that also means, you know, it's okay to have a selfish tinge to what we're going to do in terms of the world of service. Because I think for a lot of people, so I'm going to give two very quick anecdotes about that. Why selfish service is actually okay. I'm serious, because some people think like, oh, you know, we have to do this because we're going to be selfless and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Yeah, that's fine. If you don't want to do it to be selfless, do it to be selfish. And I'll give you two quick anecdotes as to what I mean by that. I was co-hosting this show called Morning Joe, which comes on very early in the morning on MSNBC, and Harry Belafonte was one of the guests that day, and so we're having this conversation with Harry Belafonte. I don't know if you guys know Harry Belafonte, singer from a lot of heads like I have no idea who he is. He's a singer. You're like Dale. That's Harry Belafonte, right? But he was an amazing singer, and like, you know, one of like the early, like the crooners, one of the earliest sex symbols and all this kind of stuff. But he was also very much a social activist. And he really used his celebrity as a way to address issues that were very important. And I asked him about that because I said, you know, there are a lot of celebrities who do not use that platform to talk about issues. And for a lot of them, it's because it hurts their bottom lines. So they're like, I don't get involved in issues that might be touchy because it might hurt my career. So I just stay away from it. You know, everyone knows the kind of the old analogy, like, you know, the Michael Jordan story where they wanted to endorse a candidate for Senate And his answer was, he's like, I like this person, but the truth is Republicans buy sneakers too. And so he never made the endorsement. And that's his choice. But you find a lot of people who will step away from making any type of declarations that in any way could be conceived as controversial because it might hurt their bottom line. But Harry Belafonte kind of went head first into a lot of these issues. And in some issues, a lot of people are like, what right does he have to talk about X, Y, and Z? But it's like, but he's like, I don't care what people think. This is how I feel, and I'm going to use my platform to do something special with it. So I asked him that question. I said, why did you choose to do that? And his answer was so interesting. He said, because there's some celebrities who wake up in the morning and they call their accountants. I wake up in the morning and I call Nelson Mandela. Who do you think has a more interesting life? Great answer. His point was, yes, we can do it because we believe in issues and all that kind of stuff, but the fact is, people who live their life for something bigger than themselves just have more interesting lives. You live better. So if you're not going to do it to be selfless, do it to be selfish. You have a better life if you live it for something bigger than just yourself. And so there's and another quick anecdote. I have a friend in Baltimore. He's an engineer, a really talented guy, really smart guy. And, you know, I wanted him to do some work with some of our kids. And I said, nothing extensive. I literally want you to come for 15 minutes and literally tell them what you do every day. That's it. Tell them what an engineer does. Because a lot of our kids, they probably have never met an engineer before. And he's like, listen, Wes, I'd love to do it. But the truth is, he's like, my service is I work with my daughter. And he's got amazing daughters. He's a tremendous father. And he's got three extraordinary daughters. And he's like, so that's my public service. I make sure my daughters are the best people humanly possible that are going to really be great and do X, Y, and Z. And I said, that's fine. And I said, but how are you helping your daughters if they can't walk down the street when the lights are on because it's too dangerous? How are you helping your daughters when the school that they go to has a 50% graduation rate? How are you helping your daughters when it's time for them to find a person they want to spend their life with? And literally, in the neighborhood that we're talking about, that 35% of the men in that area are either involved or just recently got disinvolved from the criminal justice system. How are you helping your daughters? If you're not going to do it to be selfless, do it to be selfish. Do it because we live in a better world, and you will live a stronger and better life if you can do it for someone bigger than yourself. Turn it back around, all that simply to say, if we can do a job of being able to expand the horizons of our kids and let them know we're not trying to be dream killers, but we're just trying to add in colors to the outline of the dream that you've already laid out for yourself, then I think we do a much better job of helping to ease that transition. And if they don't happen to be the number one draft pick by the Jazz, that everything doesn't fall apart for them at that point.
My name is Juan. I'm an undergrad student here at the University of Utah. And my question is, the other Wes had Tony as a male role model in his life, and he made a lot of decisions based off of that role model. Yeah. You, without having your father, and I know your uncle was important to you, was there any concepts from your father besides your middle name and the belief of getting to the heart of the story that you followed through with your life and kept thinking of throughout periods of your life that might have been brought up by your mother or somebody else in your family?
Another great question. You know, it's interesting because I always and often think about that. I remember the first time that I took my wife to go to my dad's gravesite, almost like because I wanted him to meet her. And I remember as we were walking back to the car, I said something to her that she actually often reminds me of when she says, you know, you said to me as we were walking back to the car, you said, it's amazing how you can love somebody so intensely that you didn't really even know. I think one of the things that I try not to dwell on is this idea of how different would it have been or could it have been had he had been there, because I also have, I'm very much also the belief of, you know, we don't spend your time on things that you have zero control over. That's not a very good use of your time. But I think one thing that I really took from my father that I think has helped to guide me, even though he wasn't there, was to listen about the way my mother still speaks about him. My mother still to this day has an unbelievable love and passion and admiration for a man who left this world 30 plus years ago. And I guess I often think to myself, it's like, you know, what does it mean to be remembered? What does it mean to have legacy? There are far too many people on this planet who literally, the day they're gone, the next day no one will ever speak their name again. And that's heartbreaking. Because I guess I'm of a very clear belief and a very clear idea that we've got one shot at this. So let's do something special with it. We want to make sure that long after you're gone, your work, your words, your legacy, your spirit still continues to move, still continues to inspire, still continues to touch. And I think one of the things I really take from him is this idea that I think because of his lessons, because of his legacy, because of his memory, even though, again, he's been gone for over 3 decades, we still feel him every day. We still feel like he's guiding us. We still feel like he's talking to us. We still feel like he's smiling when we do well and he's giving us a look when we don't. And that's exactly what I want. I want to make sure that we're not only doing something special while we're here, but that long after you're gone, that people will be able to look at you and say, he did it right. He worked hard, he fought, he tried, and he did everything that was ever even asked of him. I remember my sister once said to me, she said, her definition of hell is interesting. She said her definition of hell would be one day God showing her everything she could have accomplished had she only tried. And I thought that was so painful. God sitting you down and showing you everything you could have accomplished had you only just tried. I just think about in respect to my own life, I think about respect to my father's life, that the only thing that I want is that when that conversation happens, that God just looks at me and just says, job well done. You did everything you could have done. We're not promised anything. We're not promised more days, more weeks, or more years. We're not promised, you know, how much more time we have. It's not like the Justin Timberlake movie where we can look at our arms and see how many days we got left, right? So the only thing that we know is that while we're here, it becomes our real responsibility to make sure that it mattered that we were here in the first place. And I think what I take from my dad is to see the love and the passion that people speak about him. A man who's 3 decades removed from this world. And I think that's the kind of legacy that I want to try to have and inspire as well.
Hi, Wes. Karen Crompton with Voices for Utah Children. It's good to have you back in Utah.
Great to see you. And thank you for your work.
Thank you. You mentioned policy matters a lot, and you work and speak about a number of issues, but I know you're deeply involved in juvenile justice-related issues as well. Where do we get some things right in policy, and where are we really missing the boat?
Great question. In all sincerity, thank you for your service and for your work. It means so much to all of us, not only just here in Utah, but around the country, because it's important to have models that matter. And yours is a model that matters. On the juvenile justice side, I would love to say that there's more things that we do right than wrong, but I don't know if I could say that honestly. I actually think the way that we look at juvenile justice is getting better, but it's one of the more awkward and broken systems that we actually have in our society. And for this reason, is that we sometimes forget what we're dealing with. We sometimes forget that the juvenile justice system means these are children, these are kids, many of whom may have made some bad decisions, some of whom have made some very bad decisions. But these are all still our children, and we have to figure out a better way of thinking about the rehabilitation and the reentry process. That's the stated goal of juvenile justice in this country, is rehabilitation and then reentry. But if you look at the way that many juvenile justice systems are run, I think they've forgotten that. Especially when you look at how high the recidivism rate is. And for recidivism is basically the propensity for people who are arrested or inside of a facility to be released and then be essentially rearrested or put back in a facility, many of which happens within the first 3 years in the juvenile case, many of which happens in the first 5 months. So how do we think about that reentry process? How do we help that child think about what it means for them and then also what it in turn means for the society that they're reentering back into? If we have a system where a child is coming back to the same destructive environment that the child came from, we're going to have it's very difficult to understand how the results are going to be any different unless we come up with ways of establishing two generation approaches to change. We can come up with all the policies in the world for kids. If we're not doing something that's also addressing and looking to assist and help the parent and the guardian, then what's the point? You can come up with all the policies in the world helping parents and guardians, but if it doesn't in turn then turn around and assist the child, then what is the point? Two-generation policies are actually the most effective way of being able to address and think about critical issues. Another thing is we think about what that means for the education system. What happens for a lot of kids as they enter the juvenile justice system is even once they're released from a facility, they're then placed within the structure of special ed classes. Now, special ed classes serve an incredible service in this country. As a holding place for kids who get involved in the juvenile justice system, I don't know is the right answer and where that should be. And so how we help to reintegrate them back into an educational environment that makes sense for them and that makes sense for the entire educational system has to be a major priority. If you do not get a high school degree in the city of Baltimore and in many other cities in this country, you have a much higher chance of spending the majority of your adult life incarcerated than you do gainfully employed. If you look at the adult prison system in this country, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody that 66% of people who are involved in the adult prison system have had some type of interaction with the juvenile justice system. So when you look at the adult prison system, essentially what you have are kids who are involved in the juvenile justice system who have now simply gotten older, and they're committing more serious crimes. If we have an ability to actually think creatively about what juvenile justice can be, and particularly when it's talking about juvenile justice, because the vast majority of kids in the juvenile justice system are there for nonviolent offenses, a lot of them related to drugs, which is another issue. But there's ways that we can actually be very creative and thoughtful about what rehabilitation and reentry is supposed to mean. And I feel like far too many places and in far too many states and in far too many jurisdictions, we allow ourselves to get caught up in political quote breaks like quote unquote soft on crime, and we allow that somehow to dictate policy, as if that makes any sense whatsoever. No one's saying be easy on crime. No one's saying, oh yeah, this person did X, Y, and Z and they're violent and so on and so forth. Well, why don't you let them sleep in your house tonight? No one's saying that. But what we are saying is that there are ways to intervene early where you can make a marked difference. We can look at sometimes people who are committing very serious crimes when they're 18 years old and when they're 22 years old and when they're 25 years old. And the question shouldn't be, why did they commit that crime then? The larger question should be, where were we when they were 12? Where were we when they were 8? Where were we when they were 14? We can't turn around and just show this massive level of outrage now unless we're willing to actually look deeper into the causes of these issues and say, was there not a better way to intervene earlier? Because if there's one reality about all of our kids, and you know this better than anyone, there's one reality about all of our kids are going to learn. So the bigger question then becomes, who are they learning from and what are they learning? If we don't come up with a better answer for that, then I have a feeling you're gonna come up with a situation where you got a lot of people who really could care less, because as I've always said, if a person doesn't care about their own life, they don't care about yours either. And that's an incredibly dangerous place to be in.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Wes Moore is the author of the best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. for podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, it's the rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in March of 2014. Wes Moore, an author and former television host, spoke at the University of Utah about education, juvenile justice, and issues affecting young people of color in America today. In this final segment, Moore takes further questions from the audience of students.
My name is Amy. I'm an architecture student. First of all, I'm a very slow reader, and I started your book earlier this week, and I finished it this morning, so it was fantastic. Wow. And thank you very much for telling the story and for your service to our country and you know, everything else.
God bless you.
And I recently had a conversation with a pretty spectacular designer and architect, and we were discussing empathy in design and how we're largely a profession of people who listen to a client and have the ability to respond and imagine a greater future. And my question is, I guess, initially, out of the blocks, what have you seen as positive fallout from your efforts and from this book that can kind of start a conversation on how we can start to respond in the future?
Love that. Good question. And also, I'd say, I thank you for your work and your service, too, because I'm a huge believer in the idea that where we place a person says a whole lot to them without us having to say a word to them. And so, hence, if we have students who are going to schools that were built at the turn of the century and look more like prisons than anything else, then again, we're making a very declarative statement to them without having to say a word. We're letting them know simply by the buildings that they're walking into what we expect from their future. So I'm thankful for what you do and how you and the visionary work that you're actually putting into the stuff that you do. One of the things I've been incredibly excited about has actually been seeing how the work has actually turned into impact. And I'll tell you from a few different levels. I'll start first talking about from the higher ed level, and then also then structuring it down to then kind of on the local piece of what we're doing. You know, for example, I work in Baltimore and so on and so forth. So one thing that's happened is this book for now, this is now going on the third year that The Other Wes Moore has been the most popular selection for college campuses for freshman year reads and that kind of thing and all this kind of program, which by the way is a really cool program. I didn't even hear about it when I was in college. I guess it's relatively new, but like where freshmen come in and all the freshmen will read a book and do something, right? And it's been really cool because one thing we then started doing was we basically said, listen, you know, that's great, and then you'll go to campus and you'll do Q&A with students, and that's awesome, and that's fine. But while we have their attention, at least for a short span of time, let's do something with it, right? Like, you know, let's come up with ways of them being able to utilize the energy and utilize the intellectual capital and utilize this unbelievable and unbounded vision that all freshman students have to actually make a marked difference on the community that they're now going to call home for at least 4 years. So we then started basically going to universities and saying, you know, we're not trying to tell you what to think. We're just asking you to ask your students to think. What is the issue that your community is dealing with that you guys can make a marked difference on? So for example, at the University of Louisville, how they have, you know, they went through the process, they selected, and so there's literally a school that is down the street from the University of Louisville that graduates around 50% of the kids that start off as freshmen. And so they asked the natural question, which was a great question to ask, how do you have an institution of higher education here and a school that's literally down the street that graduates half their kids? How does that make any sense whatsoever? And so the freshman class at Louisville was just like, all right, well, we're going to make an impact and we're going to do something about it. And so then they made a pledge. It's like, well, we know that by the time we graduate 4 years from then, that our class will make sure that the graduation rate for the class of freshmen who are starting at the same time is going to be at least 75%. We're going to move that needle. So we're going to make sure a lot more students actually make it across the finish line and end up getting the high school degree. And they picked a variety of different ways of being able to do it. There's one student who decided that she wanted to start a community library. There's one, and so literally going around and collecting books from other freshmen saying, we're going to have this library that students will be able to use and utilize that they did not have in their other school. You have some students who said, you know, we're going to make sure we have intensive tutoring programs for students where it's not even just a one-on-one relationship, but it ends up becoming a three-on-one, a four-on-one relationship. So no one person feels this extraordinary burden because they don't have to, because you have a whole essentially family of mentors that are then working with that one individual student to make sure that their needs are met. And then so watching how, you know, you look at the University of South Florida, who says, well, we're going to work on juvenile justice because we know that's the big issue in our area. So finding what is the issue in your area and do something about it. That has been really cool. And that's been really, that's just been really fulfilling to kind of seeing how we try to turn this idea of a story into something of a much larger, into something of a much larger movement. The other thing I think where we've been able to make marked difference is, you know, thinking about this field of juvenile justice, not just on the policy side, which again I think is incredibly important, and being able to push and prod our lawmakers to be a bit more thoughtful about this. Because that's the other thing about, you know, policy and politics and lawmakers, and I say that, you know, in all sincerity, not everyone needs to run for office. But let's not forget about the fact that policymakers and politicians, there's nobody who has a bigger bully pulpit, and there's no one who has bigger budgets to play with. So if you can get them thinking innovatively and really push them to their greatness, a whole lot of stuff can happen relatively quickly. We've seen situations where people, you know, can get a lot of stuff done, and we've seen situations where people have really big titles and do absolutely nothing. I'd rather have people in there that have really big titles and actually do something with it, and we can push people to actually get to their greatness. But watching specifically on the focus of juvenile justice, where we essentially started this program, where part of the challenge we were having with a lot of our kids is these are kids who are coming from situations that you would not wish upon your worst enemy. I mean, in no way am I downplaying the challenges that some of our kids are facing, because some of them are heartbreaking and they're unfair and it's not their fault. That's what they were born into. And they have very significant and severe chips on their shoulder because of it. But what we're trying to push and the argument that we can try to make back to them is in this journey, that even though it feels like sometimes you really are never alone in it. And so take the kids who have the biggest chips on their shoulder and then take them over to Johns Hopkins University Hospital and go take them over to the oncology unit and go introduce them to a six-year-old who has terminal cancer. And a six-year-old whose face completely lights up simply because you came over and come say hello to her. And she has months to live to no fault of her own. Take them over to the burn unit and go introduce them to a nine-year-old who literally a week ago now has third-degree burns over 40% of their body because a week ago they were sleeping and their mother was getting high and she accidentally lit the house on fire. Go spend time in those places and then turn around and tell me how tough you've got it. Tell me how tough life is. It's important that we add a sense of context and perspective to not just our own lives, but to the lives of others as well. Because when you do, you live your life differently. You understand that even on our toughest days, there are people on this planet who would trade with you in a second. And that means something. And so that's the thing I've really been hopeful and inspired about, is how exactly do we push and prod a larger conversation that's not just meaningful, but impactful. And I'm incredibly humbled and blessed that I feel like in many cases we've been able to do that.
Hi, loved your book, by the way. So this is kind of a weird question. I read Alex Kotlowitz, one of your author buddies, They're All Children Here, earlier this year, and it was, you know, a very similar kind of moving experience.
It's a great book.
And there was a concept that I couldn't put my finger on, that it was kind of, my brain was kind of going around. And it took your book and Ta-Nehisi Coates' series of articles on, you know, Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin, to kind of just nail it, where he said that, you know, in this country, young black men have no value. You know, they're not treated like they have value by society. And the kind of historical context of American racism, just kind of the weight of that just pushes the concept that your life is valueless. There's no systems to protect you or to, you know, to encourage you to succeed. And I was just kind of struck by the fact that, you know, both you and the other West had all these opportunities that were, you know, chances and non-chances, that kind of thing that you worked out and he didn't. But I guess how can we as a culture fix that idea that you know, that young black men have no value, because it seems like it would be difficult to live in the situation that you and Wes did and not get the message loud and clear that, you know, your the death of your friends does not make the news, but the death of that other kid does. What's the difference between me and that kid? Well, you know, racist. So how is that something we can fix as a nation? And can we do it through policy, or is that through just activism?
Great question. Tell me your name, sorry.
Kurt.
Kurt.
Yeah.
Thank you. Y'all asked some really good questions, man. I remember Malcolm X once said, he said, I'll debate with, and this is with all due respect to college presidents, but he said, I will debate with college presidents till I'm blue in the face. He said, I can, because he said, I know I can run mental circles around college presidents. He said, the most difficult audience to debate are students. He said, because there's no boundaries as to where their mind's going. He said, and it's incredibly difficult to be able to win that, to beat that. I just say, I'd say these are great questions. And Kurt, your question's spot on, because I think, you know, my mom used to say something where she said, kids need to think that you care before they care what you think. And I think in many ways, that's what happens with the situation for so many boys of color in this country, where if they don't feel that you care, we really don't care what you think. We really don't care how you embrace us, how you view us, whatever the case might be. There needs to be an idea, and there needs to be this feeling of collective involvement and collective engagement where people feel that there is a vested interest in them as well. And I think the challenge is that, you know, first of all, if you look at kind of the historical context and the, you know, the history, we, first of all, we can't escape our own history. And sometimes people feel like, well, because it was so long ago, or because it was this, or because it was that, that it's no longer important, and people should just, quote unquote, get over it. It's not that easy when the impacts did not stop, quote unquote, so long ago. We have seen residual impacts of the long-term history of what happened with the United States that still ring true even still to this day. We've watched institutions that have somehow been abolished, but then just taken on a different name. These type of things are not lost on communities. These type of things are not lost on individuals that are growing up in those societies. And so I think we have to do a better job of first acknowledging the breakdown, and then using that as our baseline to then be able to build it back up. And this is not saying that, oh, if we acknowledge X, then somehow this is about reparations, or this is about this, or this is about that. This is somehow, it's just about an acknowledgement that we understand the anger, we understand the hurt, and we're actually willing to make amends to be able to address it. And I think part of it comes down to this, and there was actually, and so you talk about what happened with Wes and I. I remember I always came up with this idea and this understanding that people were products of their environments. And, you know, people said it so much that you just started, I just kind of, that's the way it is. People are products of their environments. People are products of their environments. One of my favorite hip-hop songs coming up was, you know, products of their environments. I was like, that's what it is, products of their environments. And so I just ate it just completely whole, because that's what I just assumed. And I remember once when I asked Wes about that, and I said, so do you think that we're products of our environments? And Wes looked at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And I thought to myself, he's absolutely right. That we're not products of our environments, we're products of our expectations. And it's, you know, people say, well, it's a real shame you lived up to your expectations and Wes didn't. I said, actually, the real shame is that we both did. We both did. But what's important to remember about expectations, going back to your question, is that expectations that people have of themselves aren't born from nowhere. The expectations that people have of themselves come from the expectations that other people have of them. And they just internalize them and they make them their own. If we look at a kid or the community that that kid comes from and we say to ourselves, they'll be just fine. They'll graduate from high school, they'll move on to higher education, they'll be a successful father and husband and mother and wife, and we put all the tools in place to make that happen, then that's generally what kids will do. And if we don't, if we look at a kid or the community that they come from and we say to ourselves, they're probably not going to make it. They'll probably be involved in the juvenile justice system. They'll then get older and be part of the adult prison system. Then kids have a funny way of making that happen as well. Every single institution in this country, whether it be Capitol Hill or state houses or businesses or military organizations or nonprofit organizations or the state pen. They're all full of people who lived up to their expectations, full of them. And so we have to do a better job of being able to carve out what we'd hope these expectations are going to be for ourselves and for our kids. I had teachers, and I'm wrapping up, but I had teachers who, you know, thought they were doing me a favor by telling me that when I wouldn't show up for school, and they wouldn't tell anybody, they wouldn't tell my mom, they wouldn't tell, because they're like, you know, did you hear about what happened to his dad? You do know his situation, right? You do know that he lives over there, right? You know his. So in an effort to quote unquote help me, you essentially repeatedly lowered my bar. You are never helping me by lowering my expectations, never. You were never helping me by telling me that I can't compete with somebody else. And these type of structural issues that we still have to deal with, but the psychological issues that in many cases are even more dangerous, because we can create all the structural changes that we want. If we still walk in with an environment of low expectations that precedes us everywhere we go, then forget the structure stuff. None of the other things are going to matter. We have to start there. So I know that I'm rabbit, but I just want to just very quickly, I'm incredibly thankful for this time, for your leadership, and for your commitment to be part of something bigger than just yourselves. It matters to not just us, but it matters to our entire globe that you guys are part of this fight. So God bless you guys, and thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, featuring a talk by Wes Moore, author of the book, The Other Wes Moore. You can find a full recording of his talk, as well as other Hinckley forums, at our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and producer for this program. Thank you for listening.